This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Okay, lads, we'll get started. Good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. And I'm delighted to be back here at the Allingham Festival, which seems to be world famous now. I've been listening to ads for it all week on the radio. Our topic here this evening is Donegal in the Civil War. While not in the vanguard of the War of Independence, in May-June 1922, Donegal became the scene of the last stand-up fight between the IRA, pro and anti-treaty, and the British Army in the so-called Petticoat Triangle, or more correctly, the Belique Petticoat Triangle, with the latter using heavy artillery for the first time in Ireland since 1916. Following the outbreak of the Civil War, some of these IRA men, originally mobilised for the now aborted Northern Offensive, were caught up in the hostilities that followed. Four of them were subsequently executed, the only four executions to take place in the county. So to discuss these and related questions, I'm joined by, on my far left, Adrian Grant, who lectures in politics at Ulster University's McGee Campus, Derry. And he is the author of Derry, the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923, published by Four Courts Press in 2018. On my right, Brendan McSwivna, who lectures in history at the University of Galway and is the author of the award-winning The End of Outrage, Post-Famine Adjustment in Rural Ireland, published by Oxford University Press in 2017. And finally, on my left, Pádraic Travers, President Emeritus of St. Patrick's College Drumcondra and author of Donegal, the Irish Revolution, 1912-1923, published by Four Courts Press this year and launched just a few minutes ago. You're all there, I presume. Now, this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012-2023 initiative. Now, just before I start, oh, by the way, Pádraic's book is reviewed in the latest issue of History Ireland, which I don't need to tell you that because I presume you're all subscribers. just a word or two about the format here. If you haven't been at a HedgeGhoul before, bear in mind you are at school. You're meant to pay attention, sit up straight in your seat. Pay attention to what the speakers are saying because you will be expected to participate. Keith here has a roving mic. And we won't just have a Q&A at the end. You can intervene at any stage. So just put your hand up, get my attention, and we will bring you into the discussion. But remember, just keep it clean because this is being recorded and will be posted as a podcast on the History Ireland website and various other platforms. Okay, to get us started, Pádraic, could I come to you first? We're talking here about Donegal, a single county, but in many respects, you know, it may be one county, but there's several regions, several planets, some people might think. And you give a very good sketch in your book, actually. So just give us a quick kind of a rundown. What kind of a place was it a century ago?
Well, the concept of the county obviously is a relatively new thing in Ireland. Donegal is a very large and disparate county. Alexander Leckie in 1908 said that there were two Donegals, an East and a West Donegal, essentially. East with a very large Protestant population and West Donegal, which was poorer and more mountainy. And to some extent, if you're looking at the War of Independence and Civil War, you can see that pattern. But if you look more closely, you know, it's more complex than that because, as we all know, there's a North Donegal close to Derry, Inishowen, which is very much an area all to itself, influenced by the city of Derry and very much part of that economic region. And South Donegal, where we are now in Ballyshannon, which is orientated a bit more towards Enniskillen, towards Fermanagh, towards North Leitrim, towards Sligo, is a yet a different region. So it's a very complex region, Donegal, a county to deal with. But during the War of Independence, I think the east-west axis becomes very significant, particularly as in the War of Independence, the police are forced out of West Donegal and they British Army and the police are concentrated largely in South and East Donegal, more so than in West Donegal, where the IRA achieve greater success. And then later in the Civil War, the East-West division becomes important too, because so much of what happens in Donegal at the time of Civil War relates to partition. And by definition, then, it's that border county between Donegal, Fermanagh, Donegal, Tyrone, Donegal and Derry.
Brendan, I'm going to bring you in there because, I mean, and you told me to mention this, you're a non-specialist here on the panel, but you are from Ardara. What piqued your interest? that qualifies you.
Ardara.
Because we were talking about this beforehand, what piqued your interest in this period? I mean, what was happening in your neck of the woods during the War of Independence?
I suppose what piqued my interest in it of late is that I was asked to talk about it in 2016, the way other people here would have been asked. And I started to remember that when I was a kid, I'd remember my grandfather saying that he'd smuggled messages or bullets in the handlebars of his bicycle and things like that. And I remember the way he used to talk about it, and older people used to talk about it who'd participated in the Tan War, that it was almost told in a comedic manner. That people would tell these stories about how there was a night that there was to be a big attack on the barracks in Ardra, and everybody was ready, everybody was lying in wait, and the order came through that everybody was to stand down, and the fellow who came with the order to tell somebody to stand down, the fellow arrested him and sat there the whole night with him. So they used to tell all these silly little stories. And I'd never taken it seriously, so when you went to look at it, you did find, as you know, Pádraig brought out this evening when his book was being launched and Adrian's book brought out, that this was war. And even in West Donegal, even in North Donegal, South Donegal, wherever, it was war in which people were trying to kill each other and occasionally succeeding. And the scale of it was something that shocked me. But just in terms of what we'd be talking about this evening, that we'd be talking about the Civil War, I think, primarily is what you're interested in, Tommy, that as the country was moving towards the Tan War with the 1918 election, that what you saw in West Donegal is a split in nationalism, and that split took the form of rivalry between Republicans and Hibernians, and that split became violent, and the first fatalities in that period would have been the killing of a man named Anthony Heron, who was a Hibernian, who was killed by a Republican after an election rally in Glenties. So, you know, our notion of what is a civil war is something we could reflect upon. There was a violent conflict between nationalists, between Republicans and Hibernians. There was violent conflict, which Adrian can talk about, within the city of Derry, between loyalists and Republicans, and other places as well.
Yeah, maybe Adrian, just come in there just to, before we move on to the treaty split. Just like, what's the situation then along the border, the Derry sort of area? Because you know, in many ways, a lot of Donegal orients towards Derry anyway.
And Derry very much orients towards Donegal as well. Tommy, I think is one of the central points. You know, Derry as a county is very much split in terms of the way it faces. So Derry City very much looks towards the west, towards Donegal and its natural hinterland. And then County Derry very much looks towards the east of the province. But Enniskillen and Derry are and continue to be inextricably linked despite the border. And it was the case back in the early 20s as well. But as Brendan has alluded to there, in Derry City in 1920, for example, there was sectarian warfare on the streets. And some of the dynamics of the IRA operation in Derry during the War of Independence can be tracked into Enniskillen as well. So Derry was one of those places where activity levels were quite low during the War of Independence, mainly because of the extent of the security forces that were based within the city. So you had, you know, a massive army presence in Derry City. It was one of the most heavily policed areas of Ireland at that time as well. And then you had a large loyal population of unionists. So it was difficult for the IRA to operate without repercussions. And we saw those repercussions in June 1920, when 20 people were killed in the space of a week in Derry. But it's interesting, I think, from the Enniskillen perspective, when Padraig O'Donnell was an officer in charge of the Donegal IRA, his remit came into Derry City. And Padraig O'Donnell was quite a firebrand and quite an action-heavy type of character. And he butted heads with the IRA leaders in Derry because they wanted to keep things on an even keel, knowing that a sectarian reaction would usually be the outcome of any kind of spectacular IRA attack. And there was a story that Patter went to any showing officers of the IRA and said, there's 500 soldiers going from Buncrana to Derry every day. Why haven't you ambushed them? And the local officers had said, if we ambush them, then they'll bring hellfire down on us 10 times what we've done to them. So there was a dynamic of local people knowing the context and knowing what the outcome would be of certain actions. And you can see that across Ireland, but it's interesting when we talk about the differences between North, South, East and West Donegal and the different kind of contexts that Republicans operated in.
Porrick, can you just move on then to the treaty split? So what way did Donegal go, like politically and militarily with the IRA, for example?
Well, politically, Donegal, like much of the rest of the country, went very strongly pro-treaty. Political opinion, as reflected in the local newspapers, if you assume that newspapers reflect public opinion rather than lead it, most of the newspapers are very strongly pro-treaty. The one big exception is the Donegal Vindicator, based in Ballyshannon, under the influence of Eileen McAdam, who we heard a little bit about this morning. But it was an outlier. Political opinion, business, the clerical authorities, and even the Sinn Féin organisation itself divides strongly pro-treaty rather than anti-treaty. The strongest anti-treaty division within Sinn Féin itself was in West Donegal, which I suppose is significant. On the military side, again, the IRA divided, but it's very hard to discern any major pattern as to how different units of the IRA go pro or anti-treaty. I think probably the most influential is whatever way the local commander goes. And in the case of Donegal, Joe Sweeney in West Donegal was enormously influential, and he takes the pro-treaty side. Also in this area, Joseph Murray, who is quite significant in South Donegal, he takes a pro-treaty side. In terms of the TDs in Donegal, there were 6 TDs in Donegal at the time, and 4 go pro-treaty and 2 go anti-treaty, which is probably a reasonable reflection of how opinion divided on the treaty in 1921-22.
Can I just throw in a general question here? Because it seems, you know, at this remove, somewhat contradictory that the IRA units on the border and even, you know, in the 6 counties are generally pro-treaty. Like, why was that? Because you might think on the face of it, they would be more virulently anti-treaty because of partition. Adrian?
This is a really interesting one, and it was something I think that I hadn't realised the complexity of until I got into researching it deeply over the last few years. And it's that the treaty split in terms of how it affected the North is quite interesting, because when you look, for example, at the Dáil debates over the treaty, partition is mentioned in passing, sparingly, and it's all about sovereignty and oaths of allegiance rather than partition. But when you get to the IRA level as well, a priest called Father Louis O'Kane, who was a parish priest in Auchnacloy, he interviewed a lot of the 6 county IRA veterans during the 1960s. And without fail, I think most of the IRA officers that he interviewed talked about the pro-treaty side being more prepared to do something about the North, and the executive or the IRA or the anti-treaty IRA had less of a plan in place. So that was a lot of that was personified by Michael Collins, and Collins has had a big role to play, I think, in terms of trying to destabilize the North in those early years of partition. And maybe that's something we'll come back to, I think.
Brendan, do you want to come in?
Yeah. I suppose when we talk about the Civil War, people often talk about it in terms of Republicans and Free Staters. You know, that's the language that is used. And it's worth remembering that the people who joined the IRA in 1919, who may have become Free State soldiers, were Republicans. And for the history of the Tan War in Donegal, one of the more interesting memoirs that's easily accessible to people is one by a man named Mike Sheeran, who was from Glenelly, County Tyrone, who was a prominent Derry IRA man, who was prominent in a flying column in West Donegal. And he subsequently took the Free State side during the Civil War. He had a career in the Free State Army. He became a commandant in the Air Corps and had quite a decent career in the Southern Army. They say that he knew more, the people who served with him in the Air Corps said he knew more about handguns than he did about aeroplanes. But in his memoir, what's most striking about it is that when he remembers the people who were with him in the IRA in 1919 to 21, the people he remembers are most fondly were people who were on the Republican side or the anti-treaty side during the Civil War. And when he reflects further upon it, he also says, you know, we lost. We were not the victors during the Tan War. And he's very clear about that. And he proceeds to say that he hopes, that he expects that that war will come again to Ireland. And he hopes that young people understand, and he's writing in the 1950s, understand that we tried our best, and I hope that success crowns their efforts. So it's a really intriguing memoir in that he's deeply anti-partitionist, he's clearly Republican, and yet he is on the other side in this on the Free State side in the Civil War.
Tell you, I want to investigate this Northern Offensive question, right? Come back to that. But before I do, Adrian, could you just bring us back to the other side of the border, right, and just talk to us in general terms, what's happening? Because this is a huge bearing on what happens later. And I mean, the point is that up until the signing of the treaty, it seems like the Ulster Unionists basically have what they want. They have political institutions, their own local parliament, and they have the means to defend it, you know, the special constabulary, you know. But then the treaty then throws all this up in the air. I mean, it seems to me, puts a question mark over it. So that 6 month period then from the signing of the treaty up to the Civil War, just give us an idea of what's happening.
Well, it's a very interesting period of time in the North, because you have, as you say, the institutions of Northern Ireland already established and beginning to solidify. You've got a security force there as well, which is what the Northern Ireland government prioritised in its early years, was the security of the new entity. And there was an attempt to crack down as much as possible on the IRA. But then again, the IRA had been legitimised to a large extent by the treaty and by the truce period. So you had IRA officers who had been on the run or imprisoned only a few months before, suddenly walking around parts of the North in full IRA uniform. You had IRA checkpoints in rural unionist parts of the North. County Derry, for example, there were training camps in the Sperrins, and IRA officers in the towns like Draperstown and Maharafelt and places like that. And that caused a huge reaction amongst unionists who felt that the IRA was now legitimately setting up checkpoints and questioning people as they moved around. And there was a B special commander called Harry Clark from that particular area who said that if this isn't dealt with, and these IRA actions aren't brought to task really quickly, then he said there was a group of individuals within the specials who were committed to massacring as many Catholics as they possibly could, and he didn't feel like he could hold them back anymore. Now, this was in March when there was an upsurge in IRA action under the command of Collins and others. But that period in March was only a sort of a harbinger of what was to come in May, which was the Northern Offensive. And it's no surprise then that whenever that IRA, planned IRA action of an invasion of Northern Ireland from the south and a rising of IRA activists within the north, when that was attempted in May, the severe reaction from both the B specials and from loyalists generally meant that what we had was essentially a civil war in all but name in the north between unionists and nationalists, and one that was very definitively won by the unionists. Because you had a mass exodus of Republicans across the border into Donegal.
Yeah, it should also be pointed out, you know, the scale of the size of the special constabulary. You're talking about like 40,000, 50,000 heavily armed guys. I mean, it's a huge force. I mean, and this comes into the, or we'll come into our discussion later, but the practicality of the so-called Northern Offensive. Porrig, you wanted to come in?
Well, just to say, it's that exodus of IRA from the six counties into Donegal, which complicates the story of the Civil War. I mean, what you get are the local IRA, you get an influx of people from Tyrone, Fermanagh and Derry across the new border, and then you get an influx of IRA from Cork and Kerry who come to Donegal to fight a border campaign. And it's that that makes the Civil War in Ireland, in Donegal, a much more bloody event than the War of Independence. Michael Hopkinson, in his book Green Against Green on the Civil War, he points out that nowhere was the Civil War more intense and more bloody than in Donegal, for that reason, that it's not just a pro-anti-treaty, it's not just Republican free state. It's the influx into Donegal of different groups who then find themselves in conflict, partly with each other, but also partly across the border with the Special Constabulary and ultimately with the British Army.
Adrian, can you go back to you on this Northern Offensive, this Collins idea, right? The thing is, was this real, or was just a ruse to keep anti-treaty IRA on side?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's not one I can give a definitive answer to, but I suppose I can give an opinion on it. For anyone who's not aware, the Northern Offensive was a campaign that had been planned throughout the spring of 1922. And the idea was that there would be a joint force of pro and anti-treaty IRA stationed in Donegal and other parts of the border. And then in May, early May, there would be an invasion of the north. The idea was that it would be largely led by anti-treaty people from Cork and Kerry, as Porrick has mentioned, and that the weaponry and the ammunition would be provided from the pro-treaty side. So there were guns that came from the British to the Free State, to the National Army, that were exchanged with the anti-treaty IRA and sent north and then smuggled across the border by people like Johnny Haughey, who was Charlie Haughey's father from Swatra in County Derry. Now, there is a theory out there that the intention of the people who organised the Northern Offensive was not to actually invade, destabilise and essentially end the existence of Northern Ireland, but was in fact a ruse to keep the pro and anti-treaty sides together and to avoid a civil war. And there is something in that, because when the Northern Offensive was supposed to take off in the opening days of May 1922, the pro-treaty battalions and divisions on the border didn't rise. And the anti-treaty ones essentially did, leaving the small pockets of rising within the north completely exposed, which meant that the Special Constabulary and the police in the north were able to crack down really, really quickly and put an end to it. So, there's lots there in terms of there's no way to actually definitively say if it was a ruse or if it was a real thing. But when you look at how it was executed, it doesn't look like there was the appropriate planning to make it a real offensive and a real.
No, it did happen on a small scale, not too far away from here, right, Porrick, which is the Beleek Pettigo Triangle, which just give us a quick. Now, we did a head school on this before, by the way, which is on our website. You can check this one out in more detail. But Porrick, just bring us up to speed. Now, what actually happened here? What was the Pettigo Triangle?
It takes place in the end of May, June 1922, and it's that triangle of land. In Fermanagh, from Beleek on the northern side of the loch to Pettigo, which is, it finds itself on the northern side of the border, but it's inaccessible from the northern side. It's more easily accessible from Donegal. And in a sense, it's a microcosm of the whole partition debacle, that the border is imposed in a very arbitrary way, which doesn't actually recognise the demographic realities for people living in Beleek or for people living in Pettigo. In the case of Beleek, it's in Fermanagh. It's a majority nationalist town. In the case of Pettigo, it's a very strong unionist community. It finds itself largely on the southern side of the border. But as part of this northern offensive, you have a build-up of troops from IRA from across the border and IRA from Cork and Kerry in Pettigo, in Donegal along the border with Beleek, and it comes into open conflict with the Ulster Special Constabulary and with the British Army in late May, early June. It's a very serious conflict. I mean, there are significant casualties, and the British respond very dramatically with artillery, as Tommy said, with aircraft, so that very quickly there's no ambiguity as to who the victors are going to be. The British Army ultimately drive the IRA and the Free State Army back into Donegal and where they remain. But it forces Collins to review this northern offensive. Obviously, he's being somewhat duplicitous in the sense that he's secretly supporting this, but he was in London at the time, and he's forced publicly to say that, of course, he has nothing to do with these events that are taking place in Beleek and in Pettigo. He denies that he has anything to do with it. And officially, none of the National Army are involved in this conflict. But in fact, on the ground, the reality seems to be that you have both IRA, Republican, and National Army involved in fighting across the border. It ends fairly quickly, but it is a significant engagement, particularly because of the use of artillery by the British Army.
Yeah, but doesn't it give us a clear idea what a northern offensive, if it had happened, would have looked like?
A lot of the people who had come from Cork and Kerry felt themselves somewhat betrayed. They had come to fight exactly that kind of a conflict, but then they found themselves publicly disowned and left high and dry, which led to a certain amount of disillusion on the part of some of those who had come from the south to fight partition.
Now, there's another aspect of this part which you've alluded to, like the fact that Beleek is a majority Catholic village in Fermanagh. Pettigo is a majority Protestant village in Donegal, right?
Yes.
And this is a pretty 50-50 part of the country, like, in terms of religious breakdown. I mean, how close then did we come to a nasty communal Yugoslavia-type conflict? You know, if this thing had gone on for any length of time.
Well, there is a good deal of communal conflict simmering on behind the scenes, going back to 1912 with the UVF, who are quite active particularly in South Donegal. The UVF were particularly strong in the Pettigo area, for example. But I think there is an attempt by the community leaders on both sides in Pettigo to try and keep the lid on things, to leave the fighting to the fighting men and not to get involved in sort of tit for tat killing of Catholics or Protestants in isolated areas. There is some evidence that some community leaders on both sides exercise their influence to try and restrain things so that they don't turn into what you refer to as a Yugoslav kind of conflict.
And just, Adrian, you want to come in on that, because you've mentioned people, Republicans crossing the border. Like, was there much movement of people as a result of conflict in either direction?
Well, my particular interest and expertise, I suppose, is in movement from north to south, and it tended to be IRA, people with Republican sympathies, but also nationalists who felt that the new political entity and the new area known as Northern Ireland just wasn't for them. But most of the people that moved across in the initial period were on the run because they were going to be interned. Whenever the Special Powers Act was implemented in April and May 1922 by the Northern Ireland government, they were able to intern people without trial, obviously. And half of the IRA were interned on the first night alone, and the other half managed to get across the border, I think. But you had then internment of pro-treaty people, you had internment of people who were in the old Nationalist Party, the more moderate Home Rulers, being interned as well. So there was a chill factor, I think, in those early years in the north for nationalists of all stripes, and many people saw the existence of the Free State as something that could be taken advantage of. Like, if you look at the IRA nominal rolls that were made up in the 30s to do the pension lists for people that got their military service pensions, if you look at the Derry rolls, huge amount of them have Donegal addresses, so it just shows you the extent of the move across. Many of them never moved back because the pro-treaty ones tended to get jobs, as Brendan just alluded to, in the army, the air force, many in the Gardaí, and many in the civil service. The anti-treaty ones, some of whom would have moved back to Northern Ireland, struggled to get work because of their political pasts. And the vast majority of them would have emigrated to the States and Canada and places like that.
Brendan?
I speak completely as a non-expert on this, so I'm learning as much as everybody else. But to go back to that Northern offensive notion, that what that involved, as far as I understand, is these glamorous IRA men, Cork men, Kerry men, coming up and sitting around places like Ballyshannon, etc., waiting for something to happen. And in the case of North Donegal, they hold themselves up in Raphoe, which is the Church of Ireland town in the middle of a sea of Presbyterianism in the Laggan. And they're sitting around for weeks, months, waiting for this northern offensive. Coming out from Derry and Letterkenny and other places are young fellas attracted by the glamour of it all. And the town of Raphoe and the IRA, the anti-treaty IRA within the town of Raphoe and elsewhere, starts to lose coherence and starts to lose an element of discipline, which culminates in a kind of drunken burning of a shop or so forth. But to me, the notion of what a northern offensive would have looked like, I don't think it would have looked like set-piece battles across a frontier, you know, as Ken McGuinness used to call the border. But it would have involved, presumably, a continuation of the Tan War tactics. And therefore, the notion of congregating all your hard men together in the one place, you know, or in several large concentrations, strikes me as kind of foolish almost.
It could be argued it was postponed until the 1950s. That was your northern offensive. That didn't go very well, you know.
Yeah, what do you mean, my northern offensive?
No. No, you misheard me there. I'm just saying that a northern offensive of sorts took place in the 50s, you know, and that was a bit of a debacle. Yeah. Corey, you want to come back in there on
that? Well, on the movement to population. People, yeah. I mean, there's movement to population both ways. The Protestant population in East Donegal find themselves in a precarious position, and indeed in this area. And during the period of the Civil War, there were 11 big houses that were burned, which belonged to Protestant population. David Fitzpatrick once said that the option for Protestants in places like South Donegal and East Donegal by 1922 was either die-hard resistance, emigration, or coexistence. And, you know, some opted for coexistence, some opted for emigration. And some of that emigration is across the border. There was a census done as part of the Boundary Commission 1924-25 of the movement of Protestant population from South Donegal into Fermanagh. And 250 Protestants moved from East Donegal and South Donegal across the border into Fermanagh, which is, you know, it's not a huge movement of population, but in proportion to the Protestant population in the county, it is of some significance. The Protestant population in Donegal between 1911 and 1926 declines by 22%. The Catholic population declines by 6%. Now, there are other reasons for that decline in population. In part, it's due to the First World War. In part, it's due to the withdrawal of the British Army and so on. But there is, from towns like this, from Ballyshannon, from Letterkenny, there is a movement of population, Protestant population, from the town, not so much from the surrounding countryside, but from the major towns. There is a drop in population. And some of that movement is across the border, either into County Derry or into Fermanagh or into Tyrone. So, as I say, there is population movement in both directions. That's it.
You want to come back in, sorry?
Yeah, just in terms of movement of population, I think what is quite striking, where you look at people who are in the IRA in 1919 to 21, and you can do that with what were referred to as nominal rolls, lists of IRA members that were put together in the 1930s when there was a prospect of pensions, these lists were compiled, who was in the IRA. So they'd list a fella and they'd list his town land and then they'd list his current address. And I would have looked at the list for the company in our draw and counted them. And I think it was a third of them were living outside the country by the late 1930s. So these were young fellas who might have emigrated anyway or might not. But what was striking to me was not just with that IRA company, but elsewhere, is the number of former Free State soldiers who emigrated in the 1920s. Like once they had contributed to the establishment of this state, as might be said, they were then surplus for requirements and there was a demobilization, and others can be more precise on the dates. And there wasn't a lot going on in the mid to late 20s. So we tend to forget, I would have grown up thinking that the people who emigrated after the Tam War and Civil War were the Republicans. But I was surprised to see the number of people who would have taken the Free State side who ended up emigrating. There was nothing here for them. The state had nothing to give them.
Yeah. Now, Adrian, I want to bring you back in here because the Civil War starts, officially, is there such a thing as a Civil War officially starting at the end of June 1922 with the bombardment of the Four Courts, right? But hostilities had already kicked off in this county.
Yeah, it's an interesting tale, and it's linked back to the Northern Offensive. So the plan for the Northern Offensive was for the Rising to take place between the 2nd and 3rd of May 1922. And as I said earlier, a small group of IRA in Derry and along the border did rise that night and were quickly put down. But there was a group of joint IRA force under the command of a couple of anti-treaty officers from Cork and Kerry. And they had attempted an invasion of Derry on the night of the 3rd or 4th, I think it was, of May. Obviously a failed invasion of Derry. But the next morning, they raided a bank in Buncrana in the market square of the town. And a pro-treaty soldier in the town, a National Army soldier, had spotted this and alerted his comrades. They then came out and engaged the anti-treaty bank raiders in a firefight. Two people were killed in the crossfire, a 9-year-old girl and a 19-year-old woman. The anti-treaty bank raiders were then later that day in Newton Cottingham, another border town, obviously. And a force of pro-treaty troops were moving through the towns, spotted the anti-treaty leaders, knowing that they had raided the bank in Buncrana that morning. And one of them fired off a round at them. The next thing, another firefight broke out. And I think it was four pro-treaty soldiers were killed in Newton Cottingham that afternoon. Now, there's an engagement between anti-treaty and pro-treaty forces about 6 or 7 weeks before the Civil War breaks out. So I've always found that fascinating. And I think there are other examples of skirmishes across across the country. But that particular engagement in Donegal is fairly significant given the level of death within a 24-hour period. And it's not often recognised. We often see, as you say, Tom, where you can have a clear point of where a civil war begins, and it's the shelling of the Four Courts, as we accept, on the 28th of June. But there had been this low-level conflict between the two sides. And that goes back to, I think, as well, trying to understand the Northern Offensive as maybe a way to keep the two sides together, because there was an expectation of violence, I think, as time went on.
Does it also explain the answer to my question earlier about why a lot of the Northern IRA units went pro-treaty? Because they thought that the treaty was going to be torn up and there was going to be a Northern offensive, Maury?
Well, I mean, some of the evidence in relation to the Northern IRA declaring pro-treaty, a lot of them came across the border and said, yes, we're pro-treaty, and they declared in favour of the National Army and so on, but some of the intelligence reports from the National Army side are saying they're only saying that to get arms. I mean, if you declare allegiance to the Free State, then you will be armed. Whereas if you declare that you're anti-treaty, then you're going to be arrested and you're going to be disarmed. So there was a certain amount of people taking a particular side because they want to regroup get rearmed and move back into a border campaign. That's
well, a lot of them were later kind of shipped off to the Curragh, like,
that's right.
You know, and kind of sat around waiting for action that never happened.
That's right.
not the type of action that they had anticipated.
That's right. Know? And the Cork and Kerry contingent who had moved up were left high and dry because they...
Well, let's get on to that, Pádraig, right? Because, and I want to just go back to Joe Sweeney, right? Yeah. Because he seems to be central to the whole thing. First of all, like how effective an IRA leader was he during the War of Independence? I mean, what sort of status did he have? Like, was he up there with Tom Barry or what?
No, he wouldn't have been. Obviously, the level of activity and one of the complaints from headquarters in Dublin during the War of Independence is, you know, despite all the arms that have been shifted to, you're not doing very much. And that's a complaint that's been made. And the number of casualties in Donegal, I mean, in I think 22 in the whole War of Independence, which is a relatively small number. Not a single British Army member of the British Army was shot in the War of Independence in Donegal. The major casualties were the police. But Sweeney was a very able leader, and he is the dominant figure. And after the shelling of the Four Courts, he's the person who responds very quickly, seizing control, taking control of the spine of the county from Ballyshannon down through where they had their headquarters in Ballybuffet down to Letterkenny, and splitting the Republic of forces east and west.
And are his units then inducted into the National Army?
They become part of the National Army. On the Republican side, there is a sort of a lack of leadership. The dominant people are Sean Lehan and Charlie Daly, who are from Cork and Kerry, who are strangers in a strange land, as it were, and they find themselves increasingly isolated. I mean, they don't know the county that well. And the dominant figure in the War of Independence, or one of the dominant figures, had been Padraig O'Donnell. But Padraig O'Donnell is in the Four Courts, and then he's in jail. So there is a sort of a leadership deficit on the Republican side. And Sweeney acts fairly decisively on the Free State side, and he doesn't seem to have had much interest in the Northern Offensive. He sort of seemed to be reluctant about getting involved. Maybe he's from West Donegal and he's not much interested in East Donegal. But he certainly, partition isn't as big an issue for him, it would appear.
Brendan?
Joe Sweeney's father was a hotelier and whatnot in the Rosses. Joe Sweeney was sent to Piercer School, St. Enda's. Joe Sweeney participated in the 1916 Rising. I think Joe Sweeney was, as a person, you know, a quite courageous and brave person. He was in the GPO in 1916 and whatnot. So I think it's always important to say that part about him. When he was chastised, as I recall, and Pádraig and Adrian can correct me on this, but when he was chastised by headquarters during the early stages of the town war about not doing more, he wrote back, he said, "You have to understand, I have loyalists here. You know, there'll be a loyalist community in West Donegal and in other parts of Donegal. And I also have the Hibernians. You know, that these are people who were diametrically, you know, the faith and fatherland people, the kind of green orange men, if you can imagine such a thing. And that people like Collins and co. would have no real conception of what he was up against." And subsequently, in the west of the county, you'd hear them say in Gweedore that nothing much happened around here during the Tan War, you know, when the Republicans more or less had the run of the place. But when it came to the Civil War, you couldn't put your head outside the door for flying lead, you know, because the Hibernians and the Republicans decided to go at each other then in a different form. And that feuding between Hibernians and Republicans, you know, that continued there through the 20s and the 30s as the Hibernians kind of played footsie with the Blue Shirts and mutated into the Blue Shirts. So we had a long civil war in this county. Mm.
Pádraig, can you just go back to, because, okay, let's just sum up here, right? When the civil war breaks out, Joe Sweeney, like, basically, he holds the county for the pro-treaty side, right? That's on one side, to the west. To the east then, as Adrian has already explained, Northern Ireland has consolidated itself. You've heavily armed, you know, special constabulary. I mean, it amazes me that the anti-treaty IRA were able to do anything. that there was any kind of a conflict here. Do you follow me? That what's amazing is the tenacity of these people, right? You know, in unfamiliar terrain, they're from other parts of the country. You know, what kept them going?
Well, one of the problems I have just conceptually is we just tend to see things in binary terms of pro-treaty, anti-treaty, Republican, free stater. And it's a bit more complicated. There are people, you know, who aren't quite sure of the ideological position they want to take. There's a lot of people who just don't want to get involved. There's a lot of people step back who were active in the War of Independence, but who just get disillusioned and step away from it. And then there are a lot of people who are free state, who are very Republican, and there are a lot of Republicans who aren't terribly interested in partition. So it's a rather complex kind of a picture. But very quickly, I mean, after the ending, the Bleak affair, and after the ending of the Northern Offensive, and after the death of Collins, it's a short run affair. I mean, by the late summer of 1922. The Republicans are on the run. Their forces are divided between a small group in East Donegal and another group in West Donegal. But they keep reporting to headquarters, and it really is heartrending to read some of the reports back to, you know, Republican headquarters in Dublin, talking about the disinterest of the people, the poverty of the people.
I ask a question, Paulie. How do they physically report to headquarters? I mean, the point is they have to go to this town for starters, right? It's one bridge. You say one very narrow bridge.
Yeah, the messages are carried. One of the people who carried messages was active in Cumann na mBan,
Etna Coyle.
She spends a good deal of her time carrying messages, and a major stumbling block is Ballyshannon, because during the War of Independence, the British blocked the arch bridge in Ballyshannon, and you couldn't move north or south across the river without them knowing. And then during the Civil War, the bridge in Ballyshannon is held more or less throughout by the Free State or the National Army. So communication is particularly problematic, but it's carried by couriers, and Etna Coyle is one of those. Etna Coyle, who was very active in enforcing the Belfast boycott, she's arrested in September 1922. She's imprisoned for a number of weeks in the Rock barracks in Ballyshannon. She writes complaining to the commander of the Free State troops in the Rock Barracks, saying that, you know, I was held in Mountjoy and I was better treated in Mountjoy by the British during the war than I am by the Free State. And he replied saying that you wanted to be treated by like a man, so we're treating you like a man. We're treating you exactly like you would. Her mother wrote to the parish priest in the Rock, or the curate, as it was, in the Rock parish, complaining that the daughter wasn't allowed to go to attend mass in the Rock. She was being held in the barracks. And the priest wrote back saying that if half of what has been reported about her daughter is true, then he wouldn't want the congregation in the Rock mixing with such a firebrand Republican. But she's enormously interesting because she does talk about, and she's a committed Republican, but she talks about a breakdown in discipline from the late summer of 1922. She says that a lot of it has to do with people from across the border. She blames people who came in from Tyrone and Fermanagh who were causing trouble, but also people who came in after the treaty to join the IRA. And she complains about the lack of discipline, which is bringing the Republican cause into disrepute.
Yeah. Okay, I want to move on to the probably most controversial aspect of the Civil War in this county, which is the Drumbo executions. But before I do, I just want to just put the flag up here. If anyone wants to come in with a question or whatever, now is your chance before we finish up. The reason I want to move on to this is that given the weak position of the anti-treaty forces, why was it necessary to carry out these executions? Maybe Paulie, tell us just what happened here.
Well, one of the leading figures on the Republican side was Charlie Daly from Kerry. He was second in command on the Republican side. He was arrested with seven others, and Free State had passed legislation that you could be tried and executed for carrying of arms, which he clearly was guilty of. But it was he was sentenced to death with seven others. But it was expected that that would never eventuate, that he would never actually be executed. But then there was an incident in Krisla, where the Free State garrison, there was allegedly an attack on it, where Captain Bernard Gannon was shot by rifle fire. And as a retaliation for that, it was decided, there were orders from headquarters in Dublin, that Charlie Daly and three others, Daniel Enright, Sean Larkin from South Derry, and Timothy O'Sullivan, should be executed at Drumbull. And those are the Drumbull martyrs. It was rather unusual. I mean, as I say, the pretext was the killing of a Free State soldier. Father O'Donnell later alleged that there were no Republicans operating in that area at the time, and that there is a good deal of contention about what actually happened. But it was a totally unnecessary execution, because as for all practical purposes, by the time of the executions at Drumbull in March 1923, the civil war in Donegal was largely over. And it seems to me that the decision to execute four people, three of them from Kerry, had a lot more to do with what was happening in Kerry in the Civil War than what was happening in Donegal. But the unfortunate thing is that Charlie Daly and others paid the price of that. As I say, I don't think it had an awful lot to do with the reality of what was happening in Donegal, and it had more to do with the continuing conflict, which had become quite atrocious in Kerry at the time.
Adrian, yeah?
I think Parik's right on that, because there's an interesting dynamic in the Drumbull executions, and that is that Sean Larkin was from the north, from the six counties. And there seems to have been some recognition or some feeling within the Free State that even an anti-treaty fighter from the six counties shouldn't be executed. So the southern nature of those executions, I think, is emphasized by that fact. Now, it's interesting because it's always been sort of thought that you know, Sweeney just went gung-ho and executed the four men. But from some of the recollections of the Northerners who had been fighting on the anti-treaty side, they have said that they think it was a mistake that Larkin was executed, that the message coming from Dublin was relayed improperly at Drumbull Castle, and that Larkin was supposed to have been reprieved. Now, for example, Tom Morris, who was an IRA commander in South Derry during the Tan War, and then later became, he says he was neutral, but I think he was essentially pro-treaty. He says that Larkin was never supposed to have been shot, and that it was a complete mistake. But Dan McKenna and Johnny Haughey actually went to Drumbull, two pro-treaty officers from the north, went to Sweeney and implored him not to execute a man from the north. Yeah. And later then, Ernie O'Malley actually interviewed Joe Sweeney, and Sweeney said Larkin was the man who was executed mistakenly at Drumbull. So there's a north-south divide here in terms of what happened at Drumbull, and it's quite fascinating, actually, when you get into the detail of it.
I agree with that, but Sweeney, when he got the orders to execute the four, he sought confirmation from Dublin that, do you really want to execute Larkin? And he got the confirmation, rightly or wrongly, yes, he should be executed. Sweeney then said he would act on orders. There was an attempt by Bishop O'Donnell, Archbishop O'Donnell, to intervene to get the execution stopped. But that was behind the scenes, and it was unsuccessful. It wasn't widely known that he had tried to get the Free State authorities to prevent the executions. And in the reprisals that followed the executions, Archbishop O'Donnell's own home in West Donegal was burned down by Republicans.
Brandon, you want to come in?
I should just emphasise, my name is McSivna, but I'm no relation to Joe Sweeney.
That's all right.
Parik's account of that would accord with my memory. I'm no expert, but my memory of materials that I've read, that Sweeney radioed to Dublin asking for confirmation of the orders he'd received, and the order came back, you're to shoot the four of them. This is the part of it which I have a difficulty with, in a sense, in that Sweeney had been at college briefly in Galway with Charlie Daly, and he did not want to participate in the execution of his friend. They'd been friends in college. This would have been presumably in 1917 to 18. And consequently, he also balked at the fact that as the senior officer present, he'd have had to be, I think it's called the provost marshal, at the executions, which means that he would have had to go over and put a bullet into the head of the hart, the coup de grace, is that the term, of the four people whom his execution he'd ordered. And consequently, he detailed another officer to do that, and he himself left the barracks. Mm. And as I said, Sweeney was a very, very brave man. To sit in the GPO in 1916 took bravery. But there's something about that aspect of it, to order somebody to pass your duty to somebody else, that I just find difficult. The person to whom he passed that order was Mick Sheeran, who subsequently became the commandant in the Air Corps. So this young fellow of 21 21, going on 22, he was 21, was detailed with carrying out the executions and making sure the four of them were dead.
By the way, if you want to get more information on the broader casualties of the Civil War, it was discussed in more detail at a previous head school on the military aspects of the Civil War. And just to briefly give it to you, I mean, there were more pro-treaty or National Army people killed in the Civil War than anti-treaty. But that's a counter for the fact that was in the early, you know, conventional phase of the war where they were attacking defended positions. A huge number of them were so-called friendly fire. In other words, badly trained, you know, recruits who were shooting each other by accident. You know, about one third of them died in that manner. But that masked the fact, though, that on the anti-treaty side, the deaths towards the end of the Civil War become fewer in number but nastier, if you know what I mean, as just exemplified by these. So it's not just the scale of it is the thing, it's the quality of it is the problem here, you know. So some of the most controversial, you know, summary executions take place very late in the conflict, and as Porrick says, where quite often there was no military justification for them at all, you know. So anyway, you can check that one out yourself. Now, guys, before we finish up, are there any questions from the floor to our panel here before we wrap up here?
There's one puzzle that I've never sorted out, and you know, it's constantly been said here that the War of Independence has been referred to as the Tan War, which I like, and I'm always fascinated by the fact that 60,000 British soldiers left Ireland in 1922. My question is, to what extent were that 60,000 British soldiers involved in what was known as the Tan War? Was it really, this is what I think myself, that the Tan War was a war between flying columns and the local police force backed up by the auxiliaries and the Tans? Mm. To what extent were the British soldiers, Barracktier in Ballyshannon or wherever, involved in that war?
I'm no expert, but like, you had the Rifle Brigade, you had this Scottish regiment, that Scottish regiment, you know, the things that became the Royal Green Jackets, the Highlanders, the this, the that. So yeah, you had Scottish regiments and English regiments and so forth in it. I don't think that there's a case to be made that there were large numbers, but I don't know, but that there were large numbers of Irish veterans, your Irish troops, Irish-born troops in the British Army, so engaged. But others would know better than me. I would say that the one casualty in my little part of the world in the final stages, the last weeks of the Tan War, was a black and tan shot at Kilrain between Glenties and Ardrah. And his name was Tom Devine. He was carted off to Lifford, died in Lifford, and he was buried in Strabane shortly after the truce. But his mother came over from Ireland to his funeral, and she spoke at his gravesite. And this was reported in the press at the time. And she says, I have no problem with the Irish people. I have no problem with the people who shot my son. I have another son. And if he came on the same business as the fella that got shot, I wouldn't have hold any grudge against the people who shot him. Because he was of Irish background. And his mother and his father were descended from people who'd emigrated in the 1850s and worked in the collieries of Yorkshire. And so she'd grown up in Irish ghetto coal mining communities. So there were certainly people of Irish extraction, you know, or who we would regard as Irish within the British Army. But if you're asking me, was there a fellow from Ballyshannon chasing people around West Donegal? I don't think so.
Yeah. There were 60,000 British soldiers left this country in 1922. To what extent were any of those 60,000 British soldiers involved in the War of Independence? That's okay, really, well, because I hear reports of auxiliaries being killed and black and tans being killed, etc., etc. The extent to which, let's say, the barracks in Ballyshannon, to what extent were they used in the War of Independence?
They were used. Yeah. Just to give an example, you know, the famous Crossbarry. Yeah. This is where regular British troops tried to surround Tom Barry, and he fought his way out. Right. The point is that quite often when regular British troops went in, the IRA would withdraw because they were outgunned. You know, so they were involved.
But in terms of Donegal, I mean, as I said earlier, there was no British soldier shot in Donegal in the War of Independence. There was one accidentally shot in Finnair. British troops were involved in the war in Donegal. I mean, one of the casualties in Ballyshannon was Thomas Rooney. He was an employee, an ex-serviceman. He'd been in the British Army during the First World War. And he was an employee of the Donegal Democrat. And he was shot at a checkpoint. There was a permanent checkpoint on the bridge in Ballyshannon, British Army checkpoint. So they were involved in various checkpoints around the country. There were relatively few direct attacks on British Army by the IRA. Most of the attacks were on police barracks, and the largest number of casualties in the War of Independence in Donegal were RAC men. Yeah.
But the IRA controlled the Rosses of West Donegal in 1920-21. Yep. And the IRA control of the Rosses was broken by the British landing Royal Marines at Burton Port. Yep. While at the same time, there's basically two roads into the Rosses. You can come by the Gibara, you can go by Doohery, you can come by Crawley, three roads. And they also sent large numbers of troops, Highlanders, rifles, etc., in that way. So the British Army was engaged on the ground during the Tan War. There's a diary by a British officer in the Imperial War Museum who was involved with the rifles in West and North Donegal that he kept during it. He talks about chasing the Blaneys around Fannet. He talks about he talks about raids and so forth around Ardrah. And that British Army officer came back to Ireland, having been in India and Africa and other colonies they vacated. And he came back in the 1960s and he walked into a shop and he asked somebody, did he recognize him, a little boy? And the little boy, said, the fella who had been a little boy, says, I did. You were a British officer here during the Tan War. But the fella who was then a shopkeeper was quite shocked because he came back with a Roman collar on him. He'd become a Catholic priest. And he ended up saying mass in the chapel in Ardrah with the IRA commandant, as was in 1919-21, as his server, which says a bit about how our revolution turned out.
On that point as well, just from the perspective of Derry, which had a very large British Army contingent in it as well at Everington Barracks and other parts, they tended to stay in barracks, but they were brought out at certain times. If there was street violence and skirmishes and riots, they were brought in to bring control to the situation. Some soldiers were attacked, beaten up, but they weren't engaged by the IRA in Derry. They tended to be just attacked by people out and about on a Saturday night.
I can think of one British Army fatality in West Donegal during the Tan War when Major Johnson was killed in Rossbeg. Major Johnson had been a major in the Inniskillen Fusiliers or whatever. So he was no longer serving, but he was...
He was an old man. He wasn't a serving soldier.
No, he wasn't serving.
He wasn't a serving soldier.
No, but he was a British soldier. But what's interesting, and Major Johnson is sometimes referenced as a Protestant. Major Johnson was a Roman Catholic. But Major Johnson's wife was arrested in Garton. His estranged wife was arrested in Garton during the Civil War running a Republican hospital. So it's a strange little county.
Now, if there are no more questions, I just wanted to wrap things up here. Pádraig, what happened in the 1923 election in Donegal when the dust had settled?
Well, there was a sort of restoration of conventional politics, if you like, in the sense I think there were 19 candidates for 8 seats.
Is it one constituency?
It's a single a single constituency. And interestingly, the poll was topped by Major Miles from Ballyshannon, who was a unionist former member of the UVF.
He couldn't get elected to Westminster. That's the interesting thing. He had to wait for the establishment of the Free State to get elected.
Yeah. he benefited from proportional representation. And in fact, he was elected in, I think, 7 or 8 or 9 subsequent elections. Mm. He was a member of Donegal County Council. He topped the poll. There was a farmer's candidate elected and 2 Republicans, including Padraig O'Donnell. And I think 4 Free State. So that was the,
yeah. But is that I mean, this always amazes me, right? That after this disastrous defeat, they still have a substantial, support. I mean, it's a minority, right? But it's a substantial minority.
Well, the vote on the treaty was 64-57. Yeah. I mean, and that you know, the republicanism didn't cease with the dumping of arms in 1923. Mm. I mean, Padraig O'Donnell continued to be Republican, and obviously some Republicans found their way from 1926 onwards into Fianna Fáil. Padraig O'Donnell took a much more socially radical view and was involved in a number of different organisations. But there was always a strong core Republican support in Donegal and indeed more generally across the country.
And just moving on then, just maybe wrap up on this, like the Suppressed Boundary Commission report 1925. I mean, like, were there still people holding out hope like that they would be shifted one way or the other? Adrian?
Yeah, I mean, when the Republican defeat occurred in the north, as I referred to earlier, and there was a mass exodus of Republicans across the border, it was really clear that the Sinn Féin strategy for the north had failed. There was a military strategy to destabilize the north, but there was also a non-recognition strategy that was directed from Dublin, which was telling Northern Nationalists to not recognize the institutions of the Northern Ireland state or government or whatever you want to call it. And that was typified by Northern teachers who refused to recognize the Ministry of Education. And teachers in the north were actually paid by the Free State government because they were refusing to recognize the legitimacy of the state. Now, that all collapsed, particularly after Collins died, and there was a lot less attention paid on the north. But when that all began to collapse, most nationalists / Republicans in the north looked to the Boundary Commission as their great hope. And I think most probably felt that Derry City, at least, would come into the Free State. There were some unionists in East Donegal who felt that they may go the other way. But when that was all shelved in what I would call the 26 county state building project, those nationalist parts of the north were given up essentially. I think most nationalists in the north realized that they were on their own at that stage. There's an interesting legacy there as well, because there were attempts in the 30s to revisit the boundary. There was reference to Palestine and how there could be land swaps. So people from the Lagan were attempting or petitioning to come into Northern Ireland.
In the leaked, the suppressed report, they were going to be shifted back into Northern Ireland.
They were indeed, yeah, and that was part of the controversy. But again, they attempted it in the 30s again, and there was talk of actually moving people en masse further into the north and transferring some Catholics out of Belfast to take the land in Donegal. You know, crazy stuff. But it just does show you that, you know, that things didn't stop in 1923. There was still the political hope of Northern Ireland becoming a failed entity economically and geographically and everything else up until 1925. Of course, the thing is, the council areas in the western periphery of Northern Ireland, Derry City, Fermanagh and Tyrone, had been nationalist controlled since 1920. Mm. And many people felt that that gave them the clout to argue that they should form part of a southern jurisdiction, because there was obviously nationalist majority areas. One of the first acts of the Northern Ireland government was to abolish PR in local elections, which meant that unionist minority control could be re-established over Derry City, Fermanagh and Tyrone. And so the institutions and the power of local government that came along with that was gone by 1924. And of course, in 1925, the Boundary Commission report was leaked. So a lot of that momentum towards destabilising the North and towards arguing that the North was unviable, all of that was kind of gone. And I would argue, you know, the inward-looking nature of the Civil War as a 26-county conflict meant that the unionist government in the six counties was able to get on with things and consolidate its power base in 1922, 23, 24, and 25.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. I'd like to thank our speakers here tonight, Adrian Grant, Brendan MacSwivna, and Padraig Travers. Our next head school will be on Zoom. Now, it's a special one. There's a documentary which it will be broadcast on TG Cahir on the 7th of December, called Maru in Iarthar Corkí, Death in West Cork. And this will be looking at the very controversial Bandon Valley massacre, in which 14 Protestants were killed in late April 1922. But we're going to have a head school on this, which will be posted in late November. And then after the broadcast date, we'll put a link up to the programme itself. So keep an eye out for that one. Listen, I'd like to thank you all very much for your attention. I hope to see you all next year's Allingham. Thank you very much.